Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Andy Bruno. He's an environmental historian and associate professor at Northern Illinois University. And we're talking about his new book, Tunguska, A Siberian Mystery and Its Environmental Legacy. Andy, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Encourage you to write this, because this could have been a very, it is in parts, a very weird book. And I know that you've done environmental writing about Russia before, but what brought you to Tunguska?
You know, there were a lot of things that brought me to it. So part of it was my own career trajectory, as a scholar and a writer. And I did a book about really heavy things like pollution in the Arctic and the Soviet project. And it was very academic in terms of trying to make scholarly interventions and kind of unwieldy, not in terms of what I hope the final product was, but in terms of the research itself. And I wanted a story. And so
was
thinking about what could I do a project on, and this Tunguska event that I had heard a bit about it, but I hadn't actually heard as much about it, given I was a specialist in Russian environmental things, as one might expect. And I was like, well, this is fascinating. And I wanted to use this event both to write, you know, a sort of responsible history of it, but also to use it as an event to engage with all sorts of questions, but allow a narrative to drive me more than, and a story to drive me more than just the larger scholarly stakes.
For people who've never heard of Tunguska, let's talk about the event. It was 1908. It was in a really remote area of Siberia. And what do we know? I mean, there was a huge fireball.
Yeah.
And then an impact area, but there was no crater.
Yeah.
There was this wild impact area where all these trees were flattened for an enormous area around 2,000 square kilometers.
Yep, absolutely. So we know, you know, it's an interesting thing because of how remote it was. We both actually know maybe more than we might have expected, but also know very little, right? So the event itself, it's June 30th, a little past 7:30 in the morning. June 7th, actually, by the Russian calendar at the time, because they were on an earlier calendar still. And there's this big fireball early in the morning. Makes the internet, it makes the press. I mean, it makes the Siberian press several days later. Some of the after effects, there were these, like, white light anomalies. They get into the international press. But then it's somewhat forgotten about until after the Russian Revolution and Civil War. And it's only then that they starts to be efforts to go discover what it was. And really, most likely what it was, and most certainly what it was the largest explosion of an asteroid fragment on the planet in modern times. But it occurred in such a remote place that it kind of was forgotten about at the time, where had it hit Manhattan, it would have been a complete sort of apocalyptic event for New York, right? So it was a really fascinating event. And the thing about it is, though, when research begins in the 1920s, there's two big things that happen. One, all sorts of evidence comes up that, yes, this happened, right? Like, people don't necessarily have great memories of something that happened 15, 20 years ago, but they remember there was a big fireball in the sky, and it was odd, and there, you know, we get hundreds of people who end up testifying to that. And the other is that once these expeditions begin, and we can talk more about that, they don't find evidence of a meteorite. And that slowly spurns all sorts of wild theories that then kind of take on their life of their own and have all of their own historical impact in terms of prompting voluntary research and expeditions and theories about alien encounters and other wild ideas.
Well, I was going to ask you, are we absolutely 100% positive it was an asteroid?
No, we're not 100% positive.
I mean, at this date, we know it happened, but we still aren't absolutely sure what it was.
Yeah, so on that point, there's a few things to say. First off, we aren't, because we don't have, you know, telltale evidence of a meteoritic event, right? Like, the comparison to the asteroid that caused the extinction of the dinosaurs, from the non-avian dinosaurs. We know where that impact crater was, and we know that it was a crater. There's all sorts of questions about whether there might have been other events that triggered that extinction, but that was 66 million years ago, and we have much more solid evidence that there was a big space object that hit the Yucatan than we do about Tunguska. That said, the things that made Tunguska seem odd, such as the lack of material and the lack of a crater, can be explained by it being a stony asteroid fragment that mostly disintegrated very low to the ground. And so you wouldn't have necessarily had an impact crater. And by the time that you're really having evidence of people looking for it, it would have often been washed away and mixed in with other parts. There wouldn't really be like big chunks on the ground for researchers to find. That doesn't mean that they aren't still looking for it. They are still looking for it. But I would say the recent understandings of how asteroid impacts can occur have dwindled the possibility that it could have been anything else.
Well, there was the Chelyabinsk meteorite that fell in 2013, which was very well documented and actually filmed part of it.
And they immediately got there and they recovered things. And I would just say, you know, in my own research, so I met he was in his 90s at the time. He was one of the initial volunteer researchers who went out to go see if aliens might have been involved. And after the Chelyabinsk fall, he's like, no, it was Tunguska was definitely an asteroid.
Except you never want to put the final bet on it.
Exactly. You never want to, you know, then that's the thing.
And that's what causes the whole thing about Tunguska. And this is what your book is about, which is really the human side of looking at a mystery.
Exactly.
And how that evolves and changes, especially under the history of the Soviet Union and Russia. I mean, this thing fell before the Russian Revolution, goes through World War I and II, the fall of the Soviet Union, and everything that happens after that. And different organizations and different groups and different people have been studying this thing, and it's been going back and forth. And it really has been the mystery that's really driven people.
Exactly. And so, you know, I just gave you sort of I felt what I had to do right there was give you the line about what the scientists think. But what I was actually interested in more is about how this is a mystery, right? The social, cultural lives and environmental lives of this event being a mystery and having this really interesting impact on the way that people relate to this landscape and think about this landscape and treat this landscape over the course of the 20th century and beyond.
Well, what's ultimately fascinating, and I want to make sure we get this in here before we run out of time or anything, is that it becomes an environmental issue because people want to preserve the site, and therefore it becomes an environmental park. It becomes a protected area.
Yep. And this is one of these things that I think is it's just a very interesting story because it lets us see a very different way of politics for environmental conservation coming into existence, the logic of it, right? Like, I mean, essentially the logic of protecting the places is more like the logic of not tampering with a crime scene than it is, saving Yosemite or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, there were indigenous people who were in the area. Is it the Evenki?
Yep.
Now, their statements weren't collected until how much later?
Starting in the 1920s, mid-1920s.
And what did they report seeing?
So they reported seeing a fireball from the sky. They heard blasts. Several of them, were quite close to the epicenter. And then one of them, it appears from a recent look at the very careful look at the testimony, one of them died, and this, I think, is just important to point out that because there's a large conception that no one died in Tunguska despite how big it was. Actually, there's pretty clear evidence that at least one Evenki man broke his arm and it got infected and he died in the middle of the Skolden Taiga. But then they, at least as we can tell through later ethnographic accounts, which have all of their own filters and politics to them, a lot of them believed that a spirit named Agdi, which emerged as an iron bird, was intervening in a dispute amongst different tribes and caused the blast. That's an Evenki belief that came up in several different of the earliest testimonies that were recorded in the 1920s.
Now, they were a culture that was dependent upon reindeer, right?
Yeah, they were.
And there was a lot of suffering of the reindeer because of the event. A lot of reindeer died.
Yeah, a lot of reindeer died. There were herds of reindeer that got smashed. There's, you know, accounts of reindeer being flung into the air and being scorched and all of this. That's part of it. And, of course, there was the forest itself that was leveled with the trees uprooted, all kind of facing out from a relatively common point or set of points.
But there was no crater at the common point.
Nope. They thought there were. And then by the 1920s, they start looking around using magnetometers. They drain a whole funnel that they think should be a crater and find a tree stump at the bottom, which means it couldn't have been an impact crater. And really later research shows that all these main places that they thought could have been impact craters were formed well before the 1908.
What's great about your book is you trace these expeditions. This is a difficult place to get to.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of stories about, and there's a lot of different people involved. But we're all going to talk about one of them, Leonid Kulik.
Yes.
He's like one of the major figures of exploring Tunguska. Who was he, and how did he get financing to take an expedition there?
Yeah, that's great. So, Kulik is really vital for the story. You know, sometimes history does end up depending on people, individuals, and he's one of these individuals that it's just impossible to imagine this story playing out without his own perseverance and idiosyncrasies and all of that. So he had been in the Russian army growing up, then becomes a revolutionary by 1905, gets on the outs, but then emerges within this world of mineralogists and becomes connected with some very famous scientists and kind of reinvents himself as a meteorite specialist. He then gets wind of that maybe there was this big fall in Siberia. He only learns about it in 1921. He lived through it but didn't know anything about it at the time. And then he starts being like, oh, we got to get there. Oh, we got it. And arranges these expeditions through the Academy of Sciences that gets him to the site in 1927. And he's immediately turns around and is like, oh, we got to go back. And he gets funding from the Academy of Sciences and some other institutions. But then in 1928, when he's out on this new expedition, he almost dies in the taiga. He's left alone because the other people on the expedition get scurvy and evacuate. And then all of a sudden, like, there's this, like, weird moment where it almost seems like they might have planned it. There's no, like, telltale evidence of it, but a scandal emerges in the Russian and the Soviet newspapers about this poor scientist who's been left to die alone in the taiga and how we have to get more money to go rescue him. And this whole big expedition comes out, and he still hasn't found a meteorite or a crater, but then gets a big money for a huge expedition in 2930. And I'm just quickly during that time, like, they still don't find anything.
Jeez.
They use everything they can, like, you know, there's from, like, you know, testing these craters to doing geodesic surveys to all of these things, to collecting witness reports, to even Kulik was reported to, like, check the beaks of birds for possible grains that could have been used for that might have meteorite fragments in them. But during this time, he kind of goes he kind of turns on everyone who's been helping him.
Yeah, he sort of goes off the edge there.
He goes off the edge, yeah. I mean, and there's all sorts of interesting ways that, like, the sources talk about it. Like, oh, he needs a rest. His nervous state needs to be hit. But he's like, it's clear both, like, he's fighting with everyone from, like, the other scientists to the workers on the ground to the Evenki to, at one point, he even gets, like, mad at his daughter, who joins him in the 1930s for another expedition and, like, makes her go hike, and then she has a big infected wound on her feet, and he has to, like cut it with a knife and douse alcohol on it so that it doesn't get to
her. Yeah, he definitely goes off the deep end, and it's I think it's fascinating. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Andy Bruno, an environmental historian and associate professor at Northern Illinois University. And we're talking about his new book. It's a really fascinating read. Tunguska, A Siberian Mystery and Its Environmental Legacy. Now, there's numerous other people involved in these expeditions, but I want to talk about the evolution of the concept of what's happened. What was this? Excuse me. It starts out, you know, yeah, it's a meteorite. Then it goes icy comet, and then UFO, an atomic explosion from a UFO, and then it keeps going into all sorts of interesting, a black hole. I remember reading that article in Nature when it first came out. People talk about dark matter and stuff. There's just this constant evolution, but it tracks sort of the sociology of the Russia and the Soviet Union at the time.
Yeah.
Like, when did the UFO idea first come up?
Yeah, okay, so that's, I mean, yeah, it tracks all sorts of, I mean, I would say it tracks both things in Russian Soviet culture, but also international, especially with the UFO idea. So, the UFO idea, it's a very interesting story, because there's actually already in the 1930s a science fiction piece that kind of is like, kind of almost proposes something like this, but it's a ship that was operated on some unknown unknown fuel, right? And then right after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where there's this science fiction writer named Alexander Kazantsev, who is out, he's in Romania at the time, so he gets wind of it more so than most Soviet people in the Soviet Union would have at the time about what, like, the characteristics of these explosions. He then is back in the fall of 1949, and he's like talking with some of these old veteran Tunguska researchers. Kulik served in the war and died in the POW camp, but he talks with some of these other people and comes up with this idea that, oh, maybe it must have been an above ground explosion if there wasn't a crater, and what could have caused that? A nuclear blast. And could there be an uranium meteorite? No. It must have been an atomically fueled spaceship that crashed over. And he writes this as a fictional piece, and it's already published in January 46. But then it's really interesting. He both kind of believes it and stages this show at the Moscow Planetarium.
Yeah, there's a photograph of that in your book.
Yeah.
And that looks totally weird. Is there a film?
I think they made a film, but I wasn't able to track that one down.
Because it looked weird. It looked definitely over the top.
It was over the top. I mean, and the description of it was totally over top. Like that, like, you know, the audience came in and like they present this, and then 30% of the amateur astronomers think it might have been a nuclear explosion after seeing this performance.
Oh my God.
And it just kind of takes off. And there's like, you know, this is late Stalinism, so it's. There was free expression, some free expression of it, but only so much. And then it was kind of, you know, shut out for a while. But then in the thaw period, where there's a bit of an opening up, and after, you know, Sputnik and the space race, you get these amateur expeditions.
Well, section of your book I found the most interesting.
Okay, yeah.
The KSE, the Complex Amateur Expeditions. So these amateurs just decide that on their own they're going to organize and get financing on their own and do these expeditions. And it becomes a thing that goes on year after year after year.
Yep. And it's both, you know, they talk about it as like tourism with a mission, right? In some ways, for some of them, like it, because it becomes like one of these many sort of alternative cultures that you find in the late Soviet period, where people are not oppositional, but they're finding their own interests and things that aren't really mainstream either, right? There's like Soviet hippies, and there's you know, Soviet yoga, and there's all sorts of things like this, and it's fitting into these trends. And but for these people, it's like they become absolutely convinced that this is the most important event to figure out, because if it's alien, they think it might be an alien encounter, that they have to really understand it and like develop that. But then they're just spending time out in the taiga and like singing songs and having campfires.
Yeah, there's a wonderful chapter. It's chapter 7, Life in Tunguska. Yeah. Is an amazing chapter. What was life like for the KSC, KSE? They were away from the cities and Soviet rule, and they were sort of on their own in this idyllic environment. Well, it's a wild environment, and they're writing the rules.
Yeah, they're writing the rules, and sometimes literally writing the rules, and they're finding ways to be there. But then also like really. Like for many of them, this becomes like the most defining thing of their lives in some
right.
ways. Like they become deeply enamored with the experience of being out there, and you know, it's hard work, it's backpacking, it's like that, but it's for them, it feels so distinctive from their urban lives, from the world that they the everyday world that they. I mean, it becomes, I'd say, a real dominant force for some of them in their own sense of selfhood and place in the Soviet world. And I mean, there's just so many wonderful stories.
Like, well, you know, first of all, it's men and women. And so
and women.
All that's going on. I mean, people are definitely getting it on. Some people get married out there.
Yes.
There's poetry being written.
Yeah.
There's all this stuff around a campfire, and people are discussing, you know, the relationship of what happened here to the cosmos. Now, even if it wasn't a UFO, a piece of outer space came down and touched right there. And that becomes an important sort of touchstone, no pun intended, but for their lives, to realize that they're connected to the greater world beyond Earth.
Yeah, and that's the thing is that there's this like, for a lot of them, there's like this agnosticism about what caused it. Like they want to think it, you know, some like the X-Files, they want to believe, but they don't necessarily feel like it's proven or anything like that. But then their experiences out there are all tainted by this, like, we are engaged in this deep mission, and we're having fun in the taiga, right? Like, like, that's what gives life meaning, is that we're being able to be, like the avant-garde of humanity's in relationship with the cosmos, while like having these love affairs and songs around the campfire and things like that.
All that despite the insects.
I mean, they complain about the insects. I mean, and it is important. Like plenty of the people who go on, there are hundreds of people go on these expeditions, and a lot of them go once and never come back. So it's not that everyone loves their time, but there's like a cohort of several, you know, I mean, probably maybe like 100, maybe a little bit more, who like for whom they just keep going back and back and back as many as they times as they can.
We're almost completely out of time, and the end story, which you tell so well in this book, is it turns into an environmental protection story, a thing about preserving the environment, which is what Tunguska is today. It's a park.
I mean, and there's also a bit about you know, there's a lot I write about, like how exactly they come to the think of it as why they should protect the environment. And we see some very interesting sort of elements of environmentalism that I think are less familiar to the West. Right. But also, you know, this, I think there is a reflection of this is a disaster in the age of climate change where it just spurs us to, in my mind, it spurs us actually to think about connections between these otherworldly disasters and how much we're all part of one system, but not in a like let's escape and colonize Mars type of way, but in a way of of thinking about the precarity of our own planet within a larger solar system. And that's sort of my, I indulge in a little, you know, armchair philosophizing by the end of the book, but it's the fact that we've lived with an asteroid disaster, I think, is something that we shouldn't just fail to appreciate.
Well, and that's the other, besides the environmental message of we need to preserve this because of the event, there's also the paying attention to large objects from outer space can smash into Earth.
Yep.
And we need to be aware of that. And it's so interesting that today, you know, we having nudged the body off of its course, we are paying attention to it. And that's part of the legacy of Tunguska, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, you went there.
Yes, I did get there. So
I'm surprised you didn't want to go back.
Well, I did want to go back, but obviously the war has made it difficult.
Right? Yeah.
This is a book that could not be written right now in the same way, because it really did rely on getting to Russia and Siberia and talking to people. I mean, I talked to, you know, 20 some of the people who had been on these amateur expeditions. Oh, I ran into Yeti enthusiasts in the Moscow library, and I also got to Vannevara, which is the closest site, and then via helicopter going around. But that is one of the stories I end with, is that I was actually supposed to go down and be able to hike around the site and see some of it, but there were forest fires going on.
That's right.
Related to climate change.
I know.
That prevented that from being able to happen.
This book covers a lot of territory. My guest tonight is Andy Bruno, an environmental historian and associate professor of Northern Illinois University. And we've been talking about his new book. It's really fascinating the way it evolves. Tunguska, a Siberian mystery and its environmental legacy. Andy, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.